Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, and Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Melody Cederstrom, and you're listening to Financial Survival, and I'm here with my co-host, Alfred Addis, to bring you our opinion and commentary on today's economic and political events. And today is Tuesday, July 12th, 2016. Good afternoon, Al.
Hello, Melody.
Well, it was a bloody day in gold today, down $2,190 for gold at $1,333.70. Still not bad for the year, just a rough couple of days that we've been having. Silver's down 20 cents today. It was strong most of the day. Came in with a little bit of a reversal near the end of the day, 2016. Platinum was down 11 bucks at 1,093, and palladium was up 2 at $631. The USDX today, I would imagine, it was... it was down slightly, 0.4 at 96.50. Crude oil was up 1.95 at 46.71. And, of course, all the paper markets today. Let me bring that up here quickly. The Dow was up 120 points at 18,347. The NASDAQ was up 34 points today at 5,022. The S&P was up 14 at 2,152. 10-year yield, everybody was pulling out of those. Everything in the world is just happy again. We're going to be talking about bubbles today, and the global equities is probably one of the biggest bubbles out there. But 10-year yield, 1.51%. The euro is still holding in there at 111, and of course, all the world markets were very joyous overnight. And you know, the global equities are pretty much back where they were before the UK voted for Brexit. You have Japan's prime minister. He won an election, and he says he's ready to order some fresh stimulus. You have England. You have London in England. You have the country, Britain. They have a new prime minister. We talked about that yesterday. So, you know, a lot of these uncertainties, and we're beginning to see, you know, that, you know, confidence come back into these markets. So a lot of this uncertainty was resolved by a lot of this news. And, of course, we also had our huge job report on Friday. But there's a continuation of a strong reaction from that. And so you have, I guess you would call that optimism, Al.
Well, you know, there was a false pessimism that afflicted the markets after the Brexit vote in the first place. Now, I've said several times on the program, nothing's actually happened so far relative to the British exit. Nothing's happened other than they took a vote.
No.
And the exit might not take place. Nothing official has happened in the sense of nothing actual has happened. Everybody's panicked on the situation, but all they did in England is take a vote. And there has been a huge reaction. It was overreaction, and now they are perhaps correcting from that initial overreaction.
Well, there were still seven funds that were shut down. You still do have the impacts in the various parts of it.
Yeah, but the reason they were shut down was not because
that.
Of the vote. It was because
but
of the people overreacting.
It was the confidence that was lost. And you and I talk about confidence on this program all the time. And you have a little breeze.
They don't have confidence. They don't have confidence in England, Melody. They have stiff upper lips.
Is that what they have?
That's what they have. They have
the rest of the world.
Instead of considering the confidence factor, they consider the stiff upper lip factor.
Well, the rest of the world will show confidence. But anyway, that was, the global markets are the markets here are hitting highs. And I think we're going to see some pressure on gold, but I still think we're going to be higher at the end of the year than where we are today.
Even if we're not, right now we're up 26% for the year.
Absolutely.
All right. If gold doesn't gain a nickel in the balance of the year, this has still been a great year for gold.
It is. That's what I said earlier. It is a great. Silver's doing fantastic, even if we remain at keep these levels. But, nothing goes straight up. We're going to have pullbacks. We're going to go up and down. And you want a little bit of that volatility as we go up. Anything that goes straight up is sure to come down a little bit. So this is a good sign to see a little bit of a pullback. 1340 was an important number. Now we'll look at 1320. But, again, it's not all about the price of gold and silver. And that's what you have to remember. Sure, if we can buy it a couple of dollars less, it's good for you. That's fine. But, you can't focus so much on the prices. You just have to get in there and you have to start purchasing. People try and time the markets.
And the idea is to follow the trend. See if you can pick up on what the trend is likely to be. And if you can, then the price is irrelevant if you are accurate in assessing what the trend is likely to be. Is the price of gold likely to go up significantly over the course of the next 6, 12, 20 months? I'd say yes. And if that's correct, then you buy now, whatever the price is. You buy now and you sit on it for 6, 12, 20 months. Okay?
And, on this program, we talk a lot about bubbles. And the term bubble in reference to a financial crisis originated early in the 1700s. It was the British South Sea Bubble. This is one of the earliest modern financial crises. This metaphor indicated that the prices of the stock were inflated and fragile, based on nothing but air, vulnerable to a sudden burst, and it did. Bubble, a rapid expansion followed by a contraction. Trade in an asset at a price that deviates from the corresponding asset's intrinsic value. Today, we are going to discuss the granddaddy of all bubbles, the global government finance bubble. And we're going to discuss this granddaddy of all bubbles with today's guest, Doug Noland. Doug Noland, for 16 years, has written his blog, Credit Bubble Bulletin, and has 25 years of financial industry experience. And I would like to welcome Doug Noland to the program.
Hi, thanks a lot for having me on today. Appreciate it.
I also want to introduce you to my co-host, Alfred Adisk.
Hello, Doug.
Hi.
I was impressed by your list of questions that you might use on the program. It really reads like the curriculum for a semester of college economics. There's more there than we're going to get to in a single program, I'm sure, but it really was a well done outline. I mean, I can see the thinking that went into it.
Let's get to some of those topics.
And I would like to throw in that maybe that when I wrote that, you caught me in an unusual mood, because usually I say when it comes to questions, I prefer easy ones. But anyway,
well,
I don't think my list was a lot of easy ones, but we'll try.
A lot of interesting ones. I prefer interesting ones to easy ones, but we'll see what we can get out of this. Why don't you tell us how it began? How'd the blog begin?
How the blog began, I guess my first interest in bubbles or in macroeconomic analysis, I had been a CPA in Portland, Oregon, moved down to Southern California for greener pastures, got a job at Toyota's headquarters down in Los Angeles in their treasury department back in 1986, 1987. And, you know, I was sitting on a fixed income trading desk when the stock market crashed in 1987. And during that whole period, you know, management at Toyota was very concerned about the bubble in Japan. They were concerned about it in, you know, 1986, and, you know, it kept going and didn't burst until, you know, 1990. But I was hooked on the analysis starting then, went back and got my MBA and then took a job with the hedge fund and then started reading the work of Dr. Kurt Rischebacher back in 1990. The late, great Dr. Rischebacher, German economist, wonderful economist, and I studied his work and started reading as much as I could. Studied the markets. The markets were doing profound things. You know, I watched the impaired banking system from the early 1990s morph, transform into this new age credit system that was fueling this prosperity and bull market. And by the late 1990s, I was convinced there was a really incredible story out there that nobody was focused on. So I started my blog. I was working with the Prudent Bear Fund. I started my blog back in 1999, and try to write about it every Friday over all these years. So when everyone else is having fun on Fridays, I'm writing my blog, but that's okay.
What is a bubble? A lot of people hear people talk about it on a regular basis, but how do you define a bubble, and what fills the bubble? What inflates the bubble?
Sure. Yeah, great question. I try to keep it pretty simple. Because the bubbles, you know, you can have all different kinds of bubbles, but let's say a bubble is a self-reinforcing yet unsustainable inflation. So generally you have a price inflation that, and it's self-reinforcing. You can have, though, right, we've seen bubbles in technology stocks and home prices and stocks. We've also seen you can have bubbles in economies, where you have an inflation of price levels throughout the economy. But underlying all of these, whether it's in the economy or in securities or in real estate or other, you know, it could be fine art, it's always an expansion of credit. There's some underlying monetary inflation and expansion of credit, which is basically the creation of new purchasing power, and it's inflating some asset. And as asset prices go up, obviously people get excited about that. They want to participate. So a lot of times they'll borrow money and buy that inflating asset, and that leads the price to go up even more. And it just feeds on itself. But as I say, at the end of the day, unfortunately, it's unsustainable. And when bubbles burst, they can cause a lot of grief, as we certainly saw back in 2008, 2009.
Are there different phases in a bubble that you can recognize?
There are. And I'll tell you, the thing with the bubble analysis is there's a lot of layers of complexity. I like to look at, you know, my analysis goes back. This is the third major bubble that I've analyzed and chronicled. The first bubble, you know, we refer to it as the tech bubble, the NASDAQ bubble, but it also incorporated corporate debt. And they usually, you know, these bubbles start out usually in a period of fear, and then asset prices start to grow or start to inflate, and credit starts to grow, and you gain momentum. And the more momentum they gain, the more difficult they are to control. Through much of the inflating bubble, the fundamentals look sound. Part of my analysis, I know a lot of people will say, well, it's not a bubble because the price-earnings ratio is not that extreme. The valuations are not extreme. In my analysis, valuation is not much of an issue because I always argue that the underlying credit growth inflates the fundamentals. So the fundamentals kind of inflate along with the bubble. So things look good. They grow together. And then at the late stage of the bubble, which I refer to as the terminal phase, that's when they become very difficult to control. Central bankers at this point often try to kind of lean against the wind. They don't want to burst the bubble, but they want to slow it. But by then, the bubble has too much momentum. And then there's also a dynamic where everyone basically has to participate. You can't sit and watch your neighbor get rich, right? That causes too much angst. And then you get the enormous flows that come in at the end of the bubble that kind of marks the end of it. But they also become very unstable and chaotic at the end. We certainly saw that. After the technology bubble burst, then you had the Fed reflate the next bubble, which was in mortgage finance. And we saw, you know, excesses in mortgage finance. We had double-digit mortgage credit growth for a number of years. And, you know, by the time you get to 2006, you have $1 trillion worth of subprime collateralized debt obligations, CDOs, these sophisticated credit instruments that were just kind of egregious that ended up all blowing up. But that's the kind of thing that happens towards the end of the cycle because all the money's coming in, everybody's excited, and things kind of get out of hand. I've argued that we're now in what I refer to as the global government finance bubble. And I do have an archive, not that I suggest anyone goes back and reads my archives, but I began warning of the mortgage finance bubble back in 2002, in early 2002. And then I started, I thought the whole credit bubble had burst in 2008. But then in, I think it was April of 2009, because of the nature of the policy response, fiscal and monetary, I began warning of the possibility of a global government finance bubble, where basically the whole U.S. bubble goes global, and it goes into all the different asset classes. And that's why I've referred to it as the granddaddy of all bubbles. And actually, it's gone to much greater extremes than I even thought imaginable, when I started worrying about it back in 2009.
When you talk about bubbles, you said that they start with fear. And what that rings in my bell, it rings my bell in this regard. If there's fear in the air, does that mean the government steps in order to offset that fear? They create these bubbles. Are they typically natural phenomena in economics, or are they artificial and man-made?
Well, that's a great question. Great question, Alfred. And Alan Greenspan made some comments about this just a couple weeks back that I noted in one of my bulletins where, you know, he and I agreed with him. He was saying the Fed's economic models do not work effectively at all as far as the financial area. They do not incorporate this important bubble dynamic. And it's Alan Greenspan's view that bubbles are just kind of a human dynamic, human nature. We get too excited and, you know, we take things to excess. Well, my argument is that might be true, but the government involvement in the marketplace is the key to these bubbles. I would argue you cannot have a long or a prolonged major bubble without a significant government involvement. If you look back at the technology bubble, why did it get so out of hand? Because the Fed collapsed interest rates, they manipulated the yield curve, they bailed out Mexico, and Mexico collapsed in 1994 and 1995. There were more bailouts. Then there was in 1998, there was the bailout of Russia and long-term capital management. So at that point, everyone knew, okay, the Fed in Washington is not going to allow a financial crisis, so everyone dove into tech stocks. The whole mortgage finance bubble was about the mispricing of mortgage finance because of the aggressive involvement of Fannie and Freddie with their government backing in the mortgage market. And I would argue that the latest bubble is because of, you know, the QE, the unprecedented printing of money, the adding liquidity in the markets, the perception that the policymakers will do whatever it takes to not allow a recession or a financial crisis. So in that
fact, I'll tell you what, we're going to have to stop here. Doug, we'll take a break, and we will be right back with Doug Noland from creditbubblebulletin.blogspot.com, and we will please stay tuned. We'll be right back.
PSA count high? Half of all men over 50 have an enlarged prostate. You can shrink your prostate without harmful drugs or risky surgery. The secret to healing the prostate is to cleanse the prostate and the liver. Call Apothecary Herbs to ask about the Prostate Kit for a comprehensive way to heal and soothe your prostate. Educate yourself on how easy it can be to disinfect, cleanse, and restore your prostate gland. Call Apothecary Herbs for the Prostate Kit and successfully reduce swelling, inflammation, dissolve stones, and cleanse the blood to obtain the results you need. Money-back guarantee with every purchase. Call the experts in organ cleansing. Call Apothecary Herbs now for the Prostate Kit and empower yourself. Toll free 866-229-3663 or international callers 704-875-8010. That's toll free 866-229-3663 or visit the web at thepowerherbs.com.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on American Voice Radio Network and Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
American Voice Radio Network is heard on Galaxy 19 at 97 degrees west, transponder 23, frequency 12115, audio PID 2595. AVR is heard on the left side audio channel, and AVR 2 is heard on the right side audio channel. Remember, both AVR and AVR 2 are on Galaxy 19. Same network, double the choices.
Hi, folks. I'm Alfred Addis here with Melody Cederstrom on Financial Survival with our guest, Greg Noland, from creditbubblebulletin.blogspot.com. But if you just look up Credit Bubble Bulletin, you'll find him. All right? The blog has been up for 16 years, and he has great understanding and insight on bubbles. When we left, broke for the last set of commercials, Greg was talking about we'd had three major bubbles. We had the tech stock bubbles, we've had the mortgage finance bubble, and now we have what Doug describes as global government finance bubble. Is government creating these bubbles intentionally, or does government create these bubbles intentionally, or do they just try to deal with them once they appear?
Well, I think they've been fighting what they call the risks of deflation, depression, going all the way back to the 1987 stock market crash. Mm-hmm. And, it's funny now, we used to refer to it as the decade of greed, and that was the late 80s excesses, which now in hindsight look almost trivial. But those excesses after, the Fed added liquidity for the stock market crash, they led to a boom and bust that had the banking system impaired in the early 1990s. And the Greenspan Fed responded to that by manipulating the yield curve and basically supporting the growth of securitization, supporting the growth of Fannie and Freddie and Wall Street Finance to help support the system because the banking system was impaired. And since then, it's just been one boom and bust after another. And the way the bubbles work, if you have a bursting bubble, if you want to reflate the system, which is always the goal of the central bank, apparently, you need a bigger bubble. So again, when the tech bubble burst, they had mortgage finance that was already growing rapidly. That was they could stimulate the housing markets and grow the economy through cheap mortgage finance. And that got away from them, just got completely away from them. And central bankers clearly never want to pierce a bubble. They want to lean, you know, they want to tighten a little bit and hope that works, and it never does. So I think this just got away from them a long time ago. And now it's to the point where, you know, this QE is globally, at least, is kind of under, out of control, but they don't have any other solution than to keep trying to keep securities markets and asset prices levitated.
But all bubbles do burst, correct?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I call this the granddaddy of all bubbles, specifically because this bubble has gone to the heart of money and credit. It has gone to central bank credit and to treasury debt, government debt globally. That's the heart of what people believe are safe and liquid assets. And a little theory here that might be helpful. Money can be very dangerous. It can be very dangerous. My definition of money is a financial asset, and I'm excluding gold only for this example, but it's a financial asset that people trust. They believe it's a liquid store of value. So if they trust it, it's dangerous because it can be issued in excess because there's insatiable demand for this so-called money. And governments can use that insatiable demand to issue a lot of money, which we've seen. And I've argued, you know, if you had a bubble in junk bonds, that bubble's not going to get out of hand because you can only issue so many junk bonds and the market's going to say, no, thank you. We got enough of that debt. We don't want any more of that. Give them government credit. Give them central bank credit. They'll take as much as offered in the marketplace. Why money's dangerous, and there's plenty of examples of this historically, is it's issued in excess. And at the end of the day, there's a crisis of confidence in the wealth, the inherent wealth of that money. And when that crisis comes, when this bubble cracks, that's when we're going to have significant problems because people may not trust central bank credit. They may not trust government debt. And after that, I don't know where the next bubble is to inflate. We're kind of at the end of the road here.
If bubbles always end badly, and that's what seems to be the case, you can, if there's been a successful bubble, you can tell us about that. But if they always end badly, why does government fail to learn that lesson? And why does government apparently keep promoting more bubbles?
It's been incredibly frustrating for me to watch and to chronicle this over the years because so many innocent people suffer from this. I wish I had a good answer. Clearly, the doctrine that central bankers follow is flawed. I call it inflationism. There is this view that no matter how big your debt mountain is, how big your severe your debt problems are, you can inflate the general price level and inflate away your previous debt excesses. And candidly, a lot, you know, people believe this because they say, hey, we have 30 years of history here of these booms and busts, and we always get out of them. And in Greenspan's interview on Bloomberg a couple of weeks ago, he made the comment, he said, bubbles are not toxic. And he said, if you go back after the 1987 stock market crash and look in the GDP data, you can't even see that the bubble burst. He said the same thing about NASDAQ. Well, my argument to that is they just reflated the next bubble, and they haven't paid the price yet because this has been accumulating now for almost 30 years. And there's a very good analysis that goes back and talks about the Roaring 20s and that bubble. That's the only one that has similar parallels to this. That bubble started with, the inflation of World War I and then, really gathered momentum in the 1990s in the 1920s, the Roaring 20s, until everything blew up in 1929. So these bubbles are toxic, but they can persevere for a long time if the government gets increasingly involved in the marketplace.
What's the difference between a modern bubble and the Dutch tulip mania from the 1600s? Was that just another bubble?
This is just a lot bigger. What I would argue here is that we've never had global finance where you had unlimited money, unlimited liquidity. you've always had restraints on the creation of money and credit historically. It either goes back to the gold standard, where the gold standard restrained money and credit growth, or even more recently, where you have bank credit dominates your credit growth, your credit system, and bank lending is restrained by capital requirements and reserve requirements. And I apologize, this is kind of technical, but what has changed, and it changed back in the 1990s, we decided we'll move away from bank credit, we'll do securitizations, and there's no restraint whatsoever on securitizations. We just can create as much of these new market-based IOUs as possible, and the securitization boom, derivative boom, market boom has all gone global. So this is like tulip mania, but it encompasses the whole world and all the asset classes. And let's keep in mind, really what we're talking about, we're not talking even about tulips. We're talking about electronic debits and credits here. Contemporary money and credit is electronic debits and credits. And unfortunately, backing a lot of it is nothing but a central bank promise or, government promises to pay the money back.
Which is nothing but a debt instrument. It implies that bubbles are ultimately inflated by debt. Is that accurate? Roughly correct? Yeah.
It is absolutely correct. There's always an underlying debt source, a monetary inflation. Debt is growing. And again, this is getting too technical, but I think it's important. Later on in the cycle, when people get nervous, that's when they say, wait, I don't want the junk bonds. I don't want the risky corporate debt. I don't want the risky mortgage debt. To keep the bubble going, you need to create credit that people trust, that they think is safe. And that's when the government gets involved. And that's what we've seen over the last 7 years. Just massive inflation of government credit. Again, the central banks and the actual governments themselves issuing debt, unlike anything we've ever seen in history. There's a myth that we've somehow deleveraged. We haven't deleveraged at all. We've just kept growing government debt and the central bank's balance sheet.
As we produce more debt, we doubled the national debt, more than doubled it in the Obama administration. As we produce more debt, does that necessarily cause an increasing number of ordinary citizens to say, wait a second, the government's so deep in debt, I don't think it can repay that debt. And therefore, I'm not going to trust their attempts to create new credit. I'm not going to trust their debt promises. I'm not going to fall for a bubble.
Yeah, and that's true. And there's another aspect of bubbles that kind of dovetails into your comments, Alfred, is bubbles are really an increase in perceived wealth and, more importantly, a reduced distribution of wealth.
Mm-hmm.
So the economy today here in the U.S., if you look at society here, if you look at Britain and Brexit, you look in Europe, people are unhappy because they see the inequitable redistribution of wealth here, right? So people don't trust the Fed. They don't trust government. They don't trust their institutions because of a system that they know is not fair. Because it's not, right? It's not fair. And people play along for a while. When the bubble's inflating, I say the economic pie is getting larger. And when the economic pie is perceived to be getting larger, people will work together, they'll cooperate, they'll integrate, because it's in everybody's best self-interest to cooperate, because everyone can get wealthier. But when the bubble cracks, then the perceptions are that the bubble starts to shrink. So yesterday's partner is today's competitor, and you have disintegration, the lack of cooperation. That's what we're seeing in Europe. That's mm-hmm. what we're seeing here mm-hmm. in the U.S. And to me, it's all about the root cause is this massive, unprecedented inflation of money and credit, yet it gets very, very little attention. It's rather astounding to me that somehow the central bankers come clean on this, and that they're seen somehow as part of the solution rather than the root of the problem.
Well, there's a lot of people getting wealthy on this, so they're just turning a blind eye to what is going on. And my question is, how long can governments continue? I mean, will they create a bubble to exceed this bubble? I mean, I can't imagine that's even possible.
They clearly will do, and they've said as much, they will do whatever it takes to sustain this. They don't call it a bubble, but I'll call it a bubble. To sustain these rising asset prices in the economic recovery. And as we see, right, a lot of the wealthy are doing extremely well in this environment, and most of the workers, unfortunately, are suffering. And I always figure for the rest of my career, I'm going to have to defend capitalism. I'll even defend globalization, because I don't think either of those are the problem. They're not the root problem. I think capitalism works exceptionally well, except in an environment of unlimited cheap money. Unlimited,
which
cheap
is
money.
To say, which implies that capitalism is a function of something like gold and silver, where the government can't simply spin this stuff out of thin air. When they can spin it out of thin air, then we have a problem. It becomes irrational.
Yes, and the price mechanisms are not going to function well, right? We provided unlimited mortgage credit at a cheap and declining price, right? If you had a limited amount of finance, if all of a sudden you have a big demand for mortgage borrowings, the cost is going to go up, and that will restrain the demand. That's the way capitalism is supposed to work. Capitalism cannot function well if central banks are going to manipulate interest rates and inject all of this liquidity. And globalization, I would argue, I'm all for free trade, fair trade, but I do not like trade where you trade IOUs for goods and services. Mm-hmm. I don't like U.S. running perpetual current account deficits, because what we're doing is we're injecting dollar liabilities. We're injecting this so-called money out into the world, right, and feeding this bubble throughout the whole world. If we were trading goods for goods, it would be a totally different trade backdrop. We would have to produce a lot of things. We would employ more people. Maybe some of the goods wouldn't be quite as cheap as the inexpensive goods we can import from China. Well, that's a sacrifice you make for having a more stable system with a more stable society.
But our wages would be higher, though, too.
And they could be. I would expect it would. Yeah.
Which is not a bad thing. I mean, we could get along well paying, while the rest of the world is paying $1 an hour, we could get along well paying $30 an hour if our market was confined and we were selling back and forth to each other. I mean, that might not be true. You can tell me if you think you agree with that or not, but at least it seems plausible. When we go into this global market, you're going to wind up, ordinary people are going to have to compete at the minimum wage level. And it can't be good for people. It would be better for everybody to make $30 an hour than for everybody to make $5 an hour. I don't think it's going to work. And maybe I'm mistaken about that, and you can correct me if you think I'm mistaken.
Well, I think there are significant advantages to global trade. But if you open up unlimited finance, and basically China has an open checkbook to invest as much as they want in manufacturing capacity, you're going to have a huge problem, right? You're going to have massive oversupply of goods, which will distort pricing throughout the global economy, the people's incomes, trade relationships. So this unlimited finance is a huge problem.
Well, let's take a break for a couple more commercials, and we will be back with our guest, Doug Nolan, from creditbubblebulletin.blogspot.com. Back in a moment. Please stay tuned to Financial Survival. I'm Alfred Addis here with Melody Cedarstrom. We'll be right back.
Financial obligations or relationship problems have you feeling stressed out? When life is too much to handle, use Apothecary Herbs Emotional Stress Formula. Feel calm and more in control with herbs especially combined to provide the organic nutrition your system needs to help you cope. Complete instructions for maximum benefit and a money-back guarantee. You've waited long enough. Call Apothecary Herbs now. Toll free 866-229-3663. That's 866-229-3663. International callers dial 704-875-8010 or order online at thepowerherbs.com.
Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
Hi, folks. I'm Alfred Addis here with Melody Cederstrom on Financial Survival with our guest Doug Noland from creditbubblebulletin.blogspot.com. All you need is Credit Bubble Bulletin. Google it. You'll find Doug's website. Under your heading, General Discussion of Bubbles, you've got a section C that says the more conspicuous, the less systemic. Now, I'm not sure what you mean by that, but I think what you mean is this. If we can clearly see a bubble, and it is conspicuous, it's a small bubble. The big bubbles, I think you're implying, that are systemic, are virtually invisible and almost impossible to see, perhaps until it's too late to do anything about them. Am I understanding that correctly or not?
Absolutely, yeah, and it's fascinating. The easiest example to kind of visualize is the technology bubble. It was spectacular, right? At the time, there were a lot of talk of tulip bulbs and things. But it was relatively narrow in scope. Even in the stock market, it was narrow in scope. And the effect on the economy was narrow in scope. So when the technology bubble burst, it was relatively easy to stimulate an economic recovery from that. The next bubble, mortgage finance. It was much less obvious, right? Very few people, in hindsight, they say they saw the bubble, but very few people thought it was a bubble. But it had a much more profound impact on the underlying incomes, spending, investment patterns in the whole economy. So when that bubble burst, it had a dramatic economic impact, dramatic. And I would argue this bubble, I hear it all the time. Doug, where's the bubble? Where's the bubble? And I say, oh, I'm sorry. It's everywhere. It's in government debt. It's in corporate debt. It's in stocks. It's in real estate. It's in the U.S. It's in emerging markets, and it's global. But because it is so systemic, because it's basically everywhere at this point, people don't see what they believe are the traditional signs of bubble excess.
Does that imply that if this bubble is invisible, can it be sustained indefinitely? Will it be sustained until people finally sort of pick up and say, hey, wait a second, is that a bubble over there? And does the bubble only pop when we see it? I mean, this is like the experiments in physics where the electron is at a particular location. It depends on whether you're watching it or not, whether or not it's at a particular location. Is something like that happening with bubbles?
Well, let's think back to the mortgage finance bubble. And in June of 2007, that's when we started to see the problems in subprime. And you had Bear Stearns close a couple of their funds for withdrawals, and you started to see a lot of pressure in the prices of subprime mortgages. And then not too long later, you saw the impact on home prices. But throughout that, People didn't think it was a crisis. They said, oh, subprime is relatively small. And the Fed aggressively started cutting interest rates. So you had a strong stock market respond to that. And you had, you know, oil surge to $145. So you had all of these signs of what looked like, an inflating bubble. But the bottom line was the bubble had been pierced in spring of 07. And it just took a while for it to build into a crisis because people all of a sudden didn't trust that mortgage credit. I would argue, and again, the bubble didn't become noticeably bursting until the failure of Lehman. I would argue the global bubble has cracks now. We've seen the collapse in energy prices. We've seen significant pain in junk debt of energy companies. We've seen the emerging markets struggle. We've seen the Chinese stock market bubble burst. We've seen global bank stock prices decline dramatically. And we've seen unprecedented declines in sovereign yields, which all indicate an underlying instability, which I'll add, we saw a similar dynamic in 2007 where you had a huge rally in treasury bonds that everyone dismissed. But that was, treasury market had it sniffed out in 2007 that we were heading towards trouble. And I think sovereign debt has it sniffed out today. So I don't think this can go on for forever because I think we're already seeing cracks. And right now we're seeing these desperate measures by the central bankers that will not work. But it does prolong, this, what I call the terminal phase of excess.
How does $12 trillion in negative yields affect the derivative markets, if it does?
Well, Melody, that's a great question. And first of all, we'll accept that government debt globally is the largest market in the world. Mm-hmm. We know that interest rate derivatives are in the hundreds of trillions. By far, we're talking the largest markets in the world. And we know these derivatives are contracts based on expectations of what interest rates might do and all these sophisticated changes in the yield curve and spreads and such. But we know that hundreds of trillions of dollars of contracts were basically entered into, and then something happened in the treasury market that no one could have foreseen, right? No one thought that German bond yields could go to negative 20 basis points and you could have, $12 trillion worth of negative yielding bonds. So I think, and there's no transparency here, I think there are huge embedded problems now in the fixed income derivative marketplace. And I think it's feeding on itself and has led to this collapse in yields and the sinking of these bank stocks out there. And I think people would be advised to pay attention to what these sovereign yields and bank stocks are telling us.
Are we riding a tiger that we can't dismount without being eaten? I mean, has it gone so far that we are just, it's just a matter of time before a terrible price is required to be paid?
And I don't like to sound like a wacko. I'm a very serious analyst. A lot of the data I use, I get from the Federal Reserve. I always have. This has absolutely followed my worst, the worst I could have imagined, and I'm very fearful. I was very worried back in 2007, very worried. I knew we were heading into a major, major financial collapse, and I've got the archives up on my website. But I was not worried about global geopolitics. I didn't have the same worries as I do today. Again, bubbles are about a redistribution of wealth, and we've done that globally now, and there will be consequences. We've already seen the tension rising significantly in the world, and so I'm really worried, and I hope people laugh at my analysis in the future and that I'm dead wrong. I'm too dire. I have an 8-year-old son, so I'm not sure. I hope I'm wrong.
You talk about bubbles being a mechanism for redistribution of wealth. Is that part of the reason why none dare call it bubbles? So long as the bubbles are generating a profit, at least for the people at the top, they're close to the media, they're close to the various outlets and the rest of it. They're not going to complain as long as the wealth is moving in their direction. they're not going to call it a bubble. Is that why? Do you think that's part of the reason why we don't see the bubbles? They're not brought to our attention by people in positions to pay attention and have the enough knowledge where they can see this. Oh, yeah, this is a bubble. No, I'm not going to say it's a bubble because I'm making money off of it. As long as I'm making money, I'm not going to call it a bubble.
Right. And in this economic structure, this financial structure works for some people, obviously. And those people are wealthier and they have more access to the media. And it's almost like there's two parallel worlds out there. There's the world that people want to believe is real, that the media buys into, that central bankers have this under control, that this actually makes sense, that the markets make sense. And there's this other world where this is crazy. This makes no
reality.
Sense at all. And I think more and more people are moving over saying this is crazy. And finally, the majority of voters in the UK made it, you know, could make a decision. And now people accept the fact that half the population, even in the US, you know, they don't trust the system, right? That's frightening to have your society not trust, you know, capitalism, not trust policymaking, Washington, not trust each other.
When you say that the system is somewhat crazy, are you saying that bubbles themselves are off in this irrational world? Are they crazy, inherently crazy?
There is a manic aspect to bubbles, absolutely, because people are making a lot of money. Let's look at the hedge fund industry for a while, and I worked in the hedge fund industry. I have nothing against it outside of it's fascinating. People are making billions of dollars. They are incentivized to take leverage positions and play the asset markets, securities markets, based on what they think policymakers are going to do. It is perfectly rational for them to do that. But is there a manic belief that somehow this can continue for a while? Oh, absolutely. Nobody wants to believe that this could be over soon. They never do, right? That's expectations get so high in the mania, and then when all of a sudden, they go from thinking, okay, since policymakers have this all under control, to say, oh my God, they don't have it under control. That's when you have a crisis. I remember 1998. The view in the marketplace was the West will never, ever allow Russia to collapse. It will never, never allow it. Well, that was exactly the psychology that led to all the leverage that led to the collapse in Russia and long-term capital management. And then, right, we would never allow a housing market downturn. Never, right? Policymakers would never. And now it is, policymakers will not allow a recession. They will not allow risk off. They will not allow even a typical downturn in the markets. Because any downturn is met immediately with more measures to inflate the markets.
What do you, and I know we all need crystal balls, but what do you expect to see or a change or something that takes us to the next step? Or people always looking for these signs to see where we're at. We know where we're headed, but how close are we? I mean, for this bubble to burst?
That's great. Another tough question, but we can look to China. China, as an analyst of credit, I'm in awe of what's unfolded in China. And there are serious cracks in the Chinese credit system, extraordinary policy measures to try to keep their system going. They actually expanded credit $1 trillion during the first quarter alone in China, which is a number unlike anything seen in human history. So China is a potential catalyst for major financial problems. At the same time, we'll look at Europe. Europe was almost unwinding in 2012. In the summer of 2012, there was a crisis of confidence in Spanish debt, Italian debt. There was fears for the Italian banking system, for Italian sovereign debt, which could have easily led to a crisis of confidence in the European banking system and in the euro. And that's when we had whatever it takes. Well, Brexit now is one step forward towards the disintegration of Europe. Italy's in the spotlight again. Italy has terrible bank problems. Europe banks are significantly impaired. So Europe is a fault line globally. the hedge fund industry and all the leverage, I think, is a fault line. So there are fault lines out there, but at the same time, policymakers are in this whatever it takes mode, aggressive, I call it just crisis management.
I think it's crisis postponement, but we're talking, we're agreeing, basically. Is there, and you mentioned strong gold and precious metals in part on your section on historic collapse of sovereign yields and current market environment. Is there a strong relationship between bubbles and the price of gold? And is that relationship, if it exists, direct or just coincidental?
Well, I'm going to borrow some analysis from Jim Grant because I think he's so good on this, where he talks about, you know, the value of gold is inversely related to the confidence in central bankers. Mm-hmm. So that works has worked very well for the last few years because when the bubble was inflating, there was confidence in the central bankers, and you have a collapse, right, in the precious metals. And over the past year, something different has happened, right? Something markedly has happened. And I don't think it's a coincidence that gold prices are going up at the same time the prices of sovereign debt are going up, because both are indicating increasing lack of confidence in central bankers, their ability to perpetuate the bubble. So I don't think it's, you know, I think gold is a very important, and silver also, precious metals, very important signal that this game is in the very late innings.
We've got about 40 seconds left. We're also in the late innings. Do you think that gold is a way of protecting people, or at least mitigating the harm of bubbles? Can they be protected by gold, or is gold not so relevant?
Well, I certainly will continue to plan on using gold to protect the wealth of my family, for my kids, and hopefully my grandkids. So I'm a big believer. There's a lot of volatility there, but I'm a big long-term believer in gold as a store of value in an age where there'll be less confidence in financial assets.
All right, Doug, we have to say
thank you.
I'm Alfred Addis here with Melody Cedarstrom. Our guest has been Doug Noland from CreditBubbleBulletin.blog. Thanks very much for being on the program, Doug, and we look forward to talking to you again. Thanks for listening, folks. We will be back tomorrow. In the meantime, the good Lord bless you, me, Melody, and Doug Noland. Bye-bye.
All night, I work all day to pay the bills I have to pay. Ain't it sad? And still, there never seems to be a single penny left for me. That's too bad. In my dream, I have a plan. If I got me a wealthy man, I wouldn't have to work at all.